non-believers, we say that person is a kafir. Allah uses the word kafir in the Quran multiple ways. One is for an unbeliever, but also uniquely is that a farmer is also a kafir. Because what is a kafir? Literally, a kafir is one who covers, kafara. Kafara is to cover something. So when we say that that person who is not a Muslim is a kafir, they're covering the truth. A farmer is a kafir because he takes a seed, puts it in the ground, covers the seed with dirt. He's covered over the seed. So he's a kafir. But not in the same meaning of a kafir as in a non-believer. In any case, I just wanted to let you know that, because if you look at this verse and you say, why is Allah calling farmers kafirs? Because that is the term that Allah uses in the Quran. So Allah says that this life that you and I lead of these five stages, not independent of one another, they're correlated, they're interrelated. He says that now think about a farmer. A farmer goes outside, he tills the land. He puts seeds in the ground, and then he covers the seed. It begins to rain, or he waters the crops, and the vegetation begins to grow. Now the farmer, he's spent weeks and months, and especially for you who live in Calgary, if you just go a couple of kilometers outside of the main city, you'll see hundreds and hundreds of acres of farmland. You'll see horses and cows, and I'm sure you've seen this before. You'll see fields of canola growing and wheat, and different products that farmers are growing. But what you will not see is that a farmer will not just plant and then leave it to rot. No, that would be foolish of them. So they put the seeds in, as the Quran says. The rain falls, as the Quran says. The farmer becomes happy, as the Quran says. And go and ask the farmer, you know, what happens when it rains? And they're overjoyed when they get the right balance of sun and rain to grow the crops and to irrigate the crops. But then Allah says, the farmer just sits back, kicks his feet up, he relaxes, and the crops that he grew, they begin to dry, they go from green, they begin to wilt, they turn yellow. And then Allah says, ثُمَّ يَكُونُ هُتَامًا, they become like straw. He didn't harvest the crops in time. It become worthless. There's no benefit to that now. Allah says, think about that example of your life. You're given the blessings of Allah. You're given this entire process of birth up until 40 years and then beyond to grow and to mature just like the crops. But what do you do with your life? You just waste it away to wither, to come into nothingness? Or do you harvest at the right time and make the most of what Allah has given to us? Allah ends the verse by saying that there is in the akhirah, in the hereafter, adhabun shadid, a very painful punishment for those who don't use the abilities that God has given, who become deluded. فَلَا تَغُرَّنَّكُمْ, don't let this world delude you. But there are some who do that. And Allah says for them is adhabun shadid. But don't forget that Allah balances the equation always in the Quran. Yes, there is adabun shadid, but there's also maghfiratun min Allah. There's also forgiveness from Allah. So Allah, our God, Allah is not a vengeful God. He's a loving God. He's a caring God. Allah does not want to see you and me go into hell. He did not create us for the hellfire. Will people have to be reprimanded? Of course. We would be naive to think otherwise. But Allah did not create us to go to hell. He's a merciful God. He is a God of rahmah. And so he says that there is also maghfiratun min Allah, and even better than the maghfirah of Allah. Now, what could be better than God's forgiveness? Ridwan. The pleasure of Allah. In other ayat, Allah says, وَرِضْوَانُ مِنَ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ, that the pleasure of Allah, that is the greatest thing that we could ever attain. Allah says then, وَمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا مَتَاءُ الْغُرُورِ, what is the life of this world if not anything except a transient, a passing enjoyment of delusion? Again, what a beautiful parable, brothers and sisters, if we looked at the world in the light of this one particular verse. Again, chapter number 57, Surah Al-Hadid, the chapter of iron, verse number 20. If we look at the farmer again, and just think about this, that a farmer goes through all of that struggle to plant and to harvest the crop, to be able to sell it in the market, to feed his family, to feed himself, to feed his livestock, maybe if he has horses or cows or chicken. He does all of that work for a goal. He didn't grow the wheat or the canola for the sake of growing it. He grew it for a goal, a purpose. Now we have to ask ourselves, is that do I use my life in this world as the goal? Is this all a goal, to eat, to wake up, go to work, go to school, get a job, make money, and repeat? Or are all of these ways to get to the goal? What is the goal? Maghfiratun min Allah wa ridwan, the pleasure of Allah. Right? So we have to recognize and ask ourselves personally, what is my purpose on earth? Why am I here? Why do I follow this path of Islam as taught by Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhi wassalatu wassalam? Am I being used by the system? Am I being deceived by this dunya? Am I being deceived by the internet, by TikTok, by Instagram, by Snapchat, by Facebook, by Netflix? Is Hollywood using me? Are the commercials and the industry of television using me as just a pawn in their game? Or is there something much greater than all of this? Now, I'm not saying don't use technology. Don't use the dunya. No, as I said, we use the dunya to get to the akhirah, to get to Allah. But we have to ensure that we think about this fact and recognize that we as believers, as human beings, as followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhi wassalatu wassalam, we have to realize that we make use of this world, but we do not let this world make use of us. We live in this world, but we don't let the world live within us. We benefit from this world, but we don't let the world benefit off of us. We use this world for what it can give us to get to Allah. And that includes even the, you know, the some of the pleasures, the halal, the lawful pleasures. But we have to be careful that we don't exceed those limits and become deluded by the world.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali.
Aperture.
Domestic violence is abuse that happens in a personal relationship. Domestic violence affects men and women of any ethnic group, race or religion, rich or poor, teen, adult or elderly. But most of its victims are women. In fact, one out of four women will be a victim at some point. The abuser may use fear, bullying, and threats to gain power and control over the other person. These signs of abuse may happen soon after the start of the relationship and might be hard to notice at first. I'm Zarine Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Affluent, educated, safe, this is Singapore's public face. But this seemingly ideal country, famously known as the Little Red Dot, has her dark secrets. The unemployment rate stands at less than 5%, and the crime rate is one of the lowest in the world. But other numbers tell a different side of her story. 1 in 10 women in Singapore has experienced physical violence or sexual abuse, and 6 in 10 have endured violence repeatedly. But only a fraction of these victims come forward to the authorities for help. This week on Aperture, we will take a walk into the world of abused spouses in Singapore and follow the journey of three abused women to learn of their trauma, hear of their heartbreak, and share their dreams. Stay with us.
When an educated society hears but does not listen.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public.
When victims are shamed into silence.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that.
When home is no longer a safe haven, where do these women find the courage to be no longer victims? Singapore, a small island nation with big dreams. Where 1 in 4 have a university degree. 90% own a home. The unemployment rate stands at an underwhelming 2%. And over 100,000 millionaires call this home. But behind the numbers, there are secrets best kept hidden.
I thought he would be a good husband. During courtship days, he really took very good care of me. He really doted on me, was very affectionate, very loving. I would say that he went out of his way to accommodate my requests, you know. So there was really no warning signs, you know, that he would change so drastically after marriage.
At 20, Rachel found out she was pregnant.
I think it's more of society's pressure than, you know, because 16 years ago, it's not very acceptable, you know, to be a single mother. And also, I wanted a complete family for my kid. So it was more of an obligation.
Just months into the marriage, the verbal abuse started.
From someone who's very loving to you, you know, who treated you like a queen, you know, put you on a pedestal, and then, you know, suddenly that someone actually tells you, you know, that you are the reason why he lost his job, you know, because of certain superstition or, you know, your birth date clash, you know, that kind of thing, and you know, it's all your fault. And then how come you put on so much weight after pregnancy? I didn't sign up for that, you know, and I can't even bear to look at you now.
This was the start of Rachel's 8-year ordeal of living with an abusive husband. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child.
We were having an argument. I was defending my point of view. And then he just snapped and he just shoved me.
Abandoned, shocked, betrayed. Rachel struggled with all these emotions.
I think most importantly is that I really didn't want to accept the fact that, you know, he was like that, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be moving on. And given the fact that, you know, we are already married and we have a child on the way, you know, I felt very trapped.
Money and the lack of close family support also reduced her options.
Emotionally, it was because my parents didn't like him. So it was a case of, like, you know, I told you so. Back then, the laws didn't allow divorcees to buy their own house, so housing would be an issue. Also, in terms of financially, I wonder if I would be able to support the child on my own.
Rachel hoped the baby would change him, make him softer, happier. But the stresses of first-time parenthood quickly dispelled her illusions.
Things got actually worse when the baby kept crying. You know, he would scream at me and ask me, you know, oh, what kind of mother are you? Don't even know how to take care of your own kid. I don't see other people's babies screaming or crying like that, you know.
His anger reached a boiling point after he lost his job and the family became reliant on Rachel's income.
He perceived it as some kind of attack on his manhood. And given the fact that I gradually earned more than him over the years, it didn't bode well for our relationship.
A few drinks, a perceived disobedience, and the cycle would start again.
He was hitting me, he was raining blows on me, and I fell over the wrong way. Yeah, I actually hit my back actually hit against the side of the coffee table. Yeah, and I just fell over. Yeah, so my back was thrown at a very unnatural angle.
Hours flowed into days, weeks into months, months into years. But all roads still led headfirst into a brick wall.
I've really lost count. I've been in A&E for my slip disc. I thrown out my back, various kind of bleeding, head injuries. I had to go for CT scan, MRIs.
All this time, Rachel chose to hide her pain and lead a double life.
Sometimes I feel like such a fraud, you know. Obviously, at home, I'm going through all these things, you know, and I already feel very injured. Injured not only physically, you know, emotionally. I feel very betrayed, you know. Feel very angry. And you have to hide all that, you know, because during work, you know, I had to be very professional, okay? And I don't want to bring my personal life into my professional life, you know, and to maintain that kind of professional respect, you know, the kind of facade that I have to put up.
On average in Singapore, 3,000 spousal abuse cases are reported each year. But family violence specialists believe this represents just the tip of the iceberg.
We also know that less than 10% of women who have experienced abuse come forward to the formal helping agencies, whether it's the police or whether it's the family service center. So what prevents these people from getting help?
One key reason why Rachel stayed with her husband for as long as she did was for her children, who never saw their father beating their mother.
While he wasn't a good husband, he was a good father. So I was very conflicted. While I had to take care of myself, I also have to consider the feelings of my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to have a broken family. I really tried to make things work. There was a lot of self-doubt. Am I too strong? Should I be more docile? Should I be more submissive? Should I be more gentle?
All her doubts were finally erased one night.
I was sleeping, you know, he just pulled me out of bed and, you know, he was hitting me. And my elder daughter actually came out of her room. She was very, very shocked when she saw what was going on. She was very brave. She tried to protect me, so she was trying to pull him off me. At that point, I think he was very infuriated, you know. So he didn't realize it was her, so he just flung her off. She was thrown against the wall. That was really the last straw for me, that she was being physically thrown off like that. It just made me snap in a way that I realized that, you know, it had to stop right there and then.
The very next day, Rachel and her two daughters moved out. Her husband immediately tried to apply for a personal protection order against her, saying that she had injured him during the fight.
The officer who processed the case, when he called me up to investigate the matter, you know, I actually showed him the reports, the medical reports, you know, and the different police reports I made over the years, you know, and I showed it to him. I mean, just look, and what do you think? So that case was actually thrown out.
She filed for divorce the very same week, but it took 2 years before the case was settled. Rachel gave up on alimony in exchange for full custody of their children.
I've always told them that whatever happened between me and their father, it's between the adults. And it's very difficult for me to say this, but I always told them, you know, that they shouldn't hate him. They are entitled to feel anger, of course, and to work on that anger, you know. But I don't want them to hate him.
The International Violence Against Women survey that we completed in 2010 was done because we felt that up to that point, as a country, as a nation, we had no idea as to the prevalence of violence against women nationwide. And we found that 9.2%, or 1 out of 10 women that we surveyed, reported they experienced physical violence and or sexual abuse from their partners.
The survey used a sample size of 2,000 women aged 18 to 60 years old and asked very specific questions. Have you been slapped, punched, and strangled? Has sex been forced upon you against your will? And out of those 1 in 10 women who answered yes, another number came to light.
More than half of them said it has happened more than once. 3 times, 6 times, you know. So we're not talking about people who, on the first instance of violence, you know, begin to go to the police or shout for help and all that.
When is domestic violence a public issue? Who has a right to intervene? Why do victims remain silent?
It's not a slap or two. I was really getting beaten up badly in public, in the house, and I still kept quiet and smiled.
Power. Control. Dominance. These are the driving forces behind domestic violence. Shame, fear, isolation. These are the shackles holding victims in place. Family, children, a happy ever after. This is what Mira hoped for when she married her first love.
We had really good chemistry. I mean, he spoke very, very well. He made me laugh.
In the first year of marriage, when Mira was 7 months pregnant, the violence kicked in.
He used vulgarities on me, calling me a f***, and I answered him back. And that's when he kicked my head like it was a football and stepped on my head. I screamed for help. I tried to open the door as I got up, screaming for my mother-in-law to help. He pulled my hair back, continued to beat me up even more. And after that, he told me why he beat me up, made it my fault, and I had to go down and apologize to my mother-in-law and say it's my fault.
The day Mira's son was born, she saw a flicker of hope.
The day I gave birth, he was awesome. That's when I felt that amazing man I married. He was there throughout the time I was in labor and all. After that, things changed completely because that night itself, drank, came back. Being in the hospital, basically I was abused terribly as I was practically bedridden in bed, vulgarities, everything. So it became a weekly affair, you could say, of getting abused physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mira's husband had a temper, and he wasn't shy about showing it wherever and whenever his buttons were pushed.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public. Imagine, he beat me up among the clubs in Serangoon Road, dragged me on the road and all. And when someone tried to come and help me and he told the guy, this is my wife, you don't touch her, you don't have any right to touch her. Nobody helped me. Everyone just watched the fun.
When Mira's husband lost his temper, it wasn't just a slap or a shove.
He's a very strong guy. He never beat me like it was a woman giving a slap. He beat me up like a guy. 2 fractures, a bleeding nose, multiple bruises to the head, multiple bruises to the thighs, to the back, an extremely swollen rib for a good 2 weeks. Name it. Been there, done that. And yeah, the last one, permanent scar for life, a slash on the face.
Beyond the physical abuse, what cut us deeply were the relentless emotional attacks that shattered her self-esteem.
Emotionally, what he would do is this. He abused me in front of his mom, his maid, his friends. He called me a prostitute. He says I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy wife. I should be grateful that he married me, that, you know, I'm living with his family and all that, and food is there and all. I should feel grateful.
We've come across many cases where you have both emotional violence as well as physical violence. And what is really striking is that when a victim relates what she remembers of the incidents, it's very often it's the emotional violence, it's the words used that, you know, actually has the deeper scars.
Mira believes her family would have intervened strongly had they known what was going on, but she chose to hide the abuse from them.
I didn't want to involve my family because I didn't want my family to look down on him. I wanted my marriage to work. Nobody gets married thinking, okay, fine, I get married today, and when am I going to divorce? Nobody does that. A marriage is sacred. A man and woman gets married, they have children, they go to work, they bring up their kids, and you know, they see their kids through teen years and all that. That's life. And that's what I wanted. Why I stuck through is not just simply because of marriage. I really loved him.
Although her family did not know about the abuse initially, her husband's family did. But they chose to turn a blind eye.
My mother-in-law saw me get abused. She watched me get abused. He's got 3 other siblings. I did seek help, crying to his sisters, younger one and older one. Younger one was very much more empathetic towards me. But they felt that they couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond control. I was always told that it's, you know, it's in my hands to change it.
By the end of their first year of marriage, Mira had obtained a personal protection order, or PPO. If her husband is violent against her, he can be fined up to $2,000, jailed up to 6 months, or both. But the PPO does have its limitations. It's not a restraining order which would prevent the abusive spouse from coming near or having contact with the victim.
The perpetrator could follow the victim to work, could call the victim all the time, send her SMSs, you know, multiple SMSs to harass her, could sort of always be within sight of the victim but not actually physically touch her. So all of these things can be intimidating, very, very annoying, disruptive to the victim's life still. And in other countries, the court has the power to actually restrict and to prohibit the perpetrator from carrying out these acts. I think those kinds, the court should actually have wider powers to make such orders in Singapore as well.
Despite the PPO, the threats continued. 10 months later, Mira moved back to her parents' house for the third time. Her husband turned up at the company where she worked.
He came to my office and he humiliated me. He was drunk in the morning, calling me the CBD in front of everyone, lunchtime.
A few days later, he broke into her mother's apartment at 6 in the morning.
He broke into my home with a knife and a brick. I had my siblings, my brother, my son and all there. He pinned me down as I had my son in my arms. He slashed me behind my ear, on my face. I was screaming. Everyone was awake in my home. It was chaos. My sister-in-law, my sister and all helped me. They took my son away. I ran out of the home. I thought he was going to come after me with a knife, but he didn't. All he did was say that he just wanted to disfigure me and leave.
Mira's husband was arrested and sentenced to more than 6 months in prison. He has just been released.
If he's going to try and come back, I would just do the simple thing. I'll call the police. I mean, I have a PPO, so I will call the police and all. And he knows that if he's going to try and come back, it's going to be even a tougher sentence this time. During my marriage, I was really afraid and I lived in fear. So at this point of time, I'm very confident. I don't need to feel afraid anymore.
Waiting, watching, standing still. More often than not, this is the norm, not the exception.
So I think Singaporeans make very good bystanders. I think that's something that is part of our conditioning. We are a society where we are peace-loving, law-abiding, and we generally let the authority take care of a problem. I think that this is a function of, one, Singapore being a fast-paced urban country where there people may not have as much time for each other. There may not be that much trust between strangers. And there is a certain attitude that we should each mind our own business.
How does the law define spousal violence? What happens to cases which don't meet the legal criteria? How do we help the most vulnerable victims?
Yes, we don't have anything. We have a self-esteem, a self-esteem, a self-esteem. If you get married, you go to where you are happy, and the child is apart, you can't see.
5.2 million people live in Singapore today. Over 2 million of them are foreigners. Drawn here by dreams of wealth, the promise of work, and the hope of love. In recent years, approximately 40% of marriages in Singapore have been between a citizen and a foreigner.
One in three of the women that are presented with issues of spousal violence are actually foreign wives. And this was actually an increase from the previous years, where it was one in five of every woman that came forward to seek help.
Love, convenience, citizenship. There are many reasons why foreign women marry Singaporean men. But one common theme recurs in these relationships.
So generally what we hear from our foreign wives is that there's a sense of fear that they're often threatened by their husbands. That at the end of the day, if they are going to report, for example, about the spousal violence incidents, they're going to be sent back to their home countries. And then they risk not able to see their children or maybe even lose custody of their children because of their citizenship or legal right to be in Singapore.
This has been Vu's story since she came to Singapore.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's tip, the love and fear of Allah when it comes to submission.
Allah, 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 Allah.
So, dear listeners, we're talking about the idea and the attribute and the aspect of a submission when it comes to the spiritual wayfaring and our ubudiyah to Allah, our servitude to Allah, and our worship to Allah. Now, we had talked about in some previous program how we need to have both the love of Allah and the fear of Allah in order to truly be submissive and to be in this state of submission, this state of khushu before Allah the Mighty, the Exalted. And so when we're talking about the love of Allah, it is because we see the manifestations or the blessings of Allah everywhere we look. And so the majesty, the greatness, and the power of the beauty of Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, envelops and encompasses a person, and in this rapture of love, the individual falls into a state of submission, a state of submissiveness, a state of reverence before this glorious and majestic beauty of Allah. Now, Imam Khomeini speaks about this state of submissiveness and submission in our ubudiyyah to Allah and our servitude to Allah in his book Adab as-Salat, where he says that this state at the beginning causes agitation to one's heart and it creates a sort of anxiety. But after this submission changes into familiarity, then this agitation and anxiety again turns into familiarity, peace, and then a state of tranquility comes about. So of course, because as an individual, we might not be accustomed to this state of reverential submission and this reverential fear and this submission out of love for Allah, right? We might not be used to this. We might not be accustomed to this. So in the beginning, it might cause a little bit of agitation, right? And of course, submission is the opposite of arrogance. And so a person who is arrogant and upright and proud, for them to become submissive, of course, this causes anxiety and agitation and frustration and stress. But even though we might feel this agitation, we need to continue this reverential submission, this ruku, this bowing, and this sujood, this prostration to Allah until it becomes a state which we are accustomed to, a natural state, a familiar state. And this, of course, eventually leads to a state of tranquility, a peace of the heart, such as the state of the heart of Prophet Ibrahim, who is known as Khalilur Rahman, the friend of the Rahman, the friend of Allah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, The Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me. نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله أنا العبد الفقير أنا. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful. My God, lock not toward those who profess your unity the doors of your mercy, and veil not those which you has exalted by its professing your unity. How will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, a heart which has been knotted by its love for you, how will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, give me sanctuary from your painful wrath and your mighty anger. O all-loving, O all-kind, O compassionate, O merciful, O compeller, O subduer, O all-forgiver, O all-covering, deliver me through your mercy from the chastisement of the fire and the disgrace of shame, when the good are set apart from the evil, forms are transformed, terrors terrify, the good doers are brought near, the evil doers taken far, and every soul is paid in full what it has earned, and they shall not be wronged.
يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرحوا باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جرد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرحوا باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جرد.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were talking about, which was this submission of Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, when it comes to our ubudiyah to Allah. Now, we've been talking about how this submission, this khushu, this reverential submission to Allah can be based upon, at the minimum, two things. One is the love of Allah, and the other is the fear of Allah. And so we've been talking about in various programs how some individuals, they are more in tuned to the love of Allah. And this is because they see the manifestations of the beauty of Allah, or they see the blessings that Allah has given them, or they realize how many misfortunes Allah has repelled from them. And so this love for the beauty and the grandeur and the majesty and the awe of Allah is something that creates this love in an individual, which of course then leads to the submission to Allah. Now, some other hearts, dear friends, are fearing. They are the ones who fear Allah. And these are people that are constantly aware of the manifestations of the glory of Allah. So previously we had said in another program that those who are in love with Allah, it is because they happen to focus on the jamal of Allah, the mighty, the exalted, the beauty of Allah. Now, the ones who have a tendency to be more aware of the manifestations of the glory of Allah, and they have this reverential fear of Allah, it is because they are in tune to the jalal of Allah, the glory, the majesty, the honor, the grandeur of Allah. So the beauty and the jamal leads to this love of Allah, and this jalal, this glory and grandeur of Allah, this awesome power of Allah leads to a reverential fear. Now, this fear is not a fear that you have from something bad or evil or something that will harm you or something that will hurt you. This is a reverential fear. You know, so for example, when you go in front of your father and you know for example you know that you've done something wrong and you're summoned to your father, right? There is this reverential fear. You know he's not going to hurt you. You know your father is not going to hit you or hurt you or harm you in any way. But still you have this reverential respect. And this respect is to an extent where it can be translated into a respectful fear, a reverential fear, right? And so this reverential fear comes about when an individual is aware of the manifestations of the glory of Allah, the power of Allah, the grandeur of Allah, the greatness of Allah, the glory of Allah. Allah hears everything. Allah sees everything. Allah knows what is in the hearts of every single individual. Allah knows your intentions. Allah knows your thoughts. Allah knows whether you are doing good or whether you are doing bad. When an individual really starts to realize these things and believe these things and have certainty, yaqeen, in these things, then of course a reverential respect and a reverential fear overcomes an individual. This is the submission of fear.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
What does the shaitan say? And you won't find most of them in gratitude. That's what he wants to take you away from. And Allah says, قَلِيلٌ مِّنْ عِبَادِيَ الشَّكُورُ. How few of my servants are grateful. So really, it's gratitude. That's at the root. And taqwa is, in essence, gratitude. I mean, don't become immersed in all this fear. هُوَ أَهْلُ taqwa. Allah is أَهْلُ taqwa. He is worthy of it. In other words, it's just, he's worthy of it. Because if it's all about fear, then you end up becoming somebody who is doing things motivated out of a very low force in the world, which is fear. Fear is a low force. Fear is how these people rule everybody. That's how they put them all, you better do this or this is going to happen, get your insurance. Or somebody sent me an ad and it was for insurance, life insurance. And it said, who's going to take care of your wife and children if you die? I said, Allah. That's my answer. They're asking me. And then they said, who's going to take care of your house payments and your this and your that if you die? I said, Allah. All the answers, I had Allah.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm your host Musa al-Bahalili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, questions, and other relevant circumstances or topics parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course of the Prophet himself, peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. So, dear Sayyid, our topic today is a continuation of the previous topic about the positioning of the child in the wider family unit. Last we spoke about the firstborn and the problems that they may face when the parents start to delegate too many responsibilities to him. And now, today, we will talk about the middle child. So, dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. We said it is quite important for a parent to understand the sequence of the child, whether he's the oldest, the middle, or the last, because each of these positions amongst his siblings plays a major role. And we spoke about the older child, and we mentioned a few things that might happen that some parents might not be aware of. Now, for example, let us look at the middle child. Now, the middle child or children who are in between two siblings, for example, they're not the oldest, they're not the youngest. These ones usually have the feeling of they themselves. They feel neglected and not loved, because they look at themselves and say, okay, I'm not the oldest who's respected. I'm not the youngest who is spoiled.
Right.
True. So I am in between, I'm in a transit between, where no one is giving me too much attention, no one's giving me enough love, no one is giving me enough care. Now, obviously, as a parent, you would love your kids the same.
Right.
But the child who's in the middle, he always compares between the two ends.
Right.
Either the child who's respected, the oldest, or either the youngest, who is spoiled. And he's like, okay, what about me?
Right.
So he always or constantly has that pain inside him of not being seen. So, and obviously with some parents, sometimes they don't have enough time for the child in the middle, right?
Either
they give most of the time to the youngest, obviously because he needs more attention and care. And so you see the parents, right, most of the times, the youngest one, they're constantly kissing him, playing with him, hugging him.
Right.
And the older one, obviously because he's older, so the parents, they kind of leave him alone, which the middle child perceives as a way of respect. And he's like, okay, what about me?
Right.
I'm here. So he would constantly, he tries to seek attention. He would constantly want people to look at him. He's constantly trying to have the attention of his parents. And sometimes because he does not understand how to deal with them, he would obviously seek it in the wrong way, or the wrong manner. It
becomes a competition for him.
Yeah, and so he would do something stupid in order for him to seek attention from his parents. And when that happens, obviously the response of the parents would be in a way of a punishment rather than trying to give him what he requires.
Right, naturally. Dear Sayyid, I will unfortunately interrupt you because we will be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing about perhaps the mentality of the middle child or middle children in a family unit. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
When we look at the middle child, for example, and we said it's important for parents to understand, and sometimes the one in the middle, the middle child, he finds it much easier for him to escape punishment. Unlike his older sibling, for example, the older ones usually, they get to cope it where he says, I'm kind of in between, no one cares about me, so I can get away with things.
Right.
So
I can fly under the radar.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes he does that, and he doesn't fear if he tries to do something bad. So this also happens to the child when he's in this age. And also you find that the middle child as well, he does not want to compete with his older sibling as well, because he thinks, obviously I'm smaller than him, I'm weaker than him, there's no point in me competing. So he kind of plays that barrier between him and the older sibling. So that creates a sense of, a distance between them in terms of relationship and in terms of siblings. So when the child has all these feelings and he's going through all these emotions, it is very important for the parents to come to his aid, at least, and create that balance between him and his other siblings.
Right.
So it's very important. And a lot of parents, like I said, in the same case that they do with the grown-up by giving him too much responsibility, the middle one gets neglected, the younger one gets all the attention and gets all the spoiling. So as a parent, you need to understand to keep that balance between your kids at all times. So understanding which child you have and which position he's located in is quite important.
Right.
And obviously, from a boy to a girl, that will change and differ in, let's say,